talking with you over the last few weeks. We've been trying to get this like done. And also, it's really my pleasure to be here talking to such a nice people who are, you know, taking out of their times to pray for God and to do good for the community. So this is really an honest, an honor and a pleasure to be with you here. So today we're going to be talking about Syria a little bit. I'd like to also thank you and appreciate that you're also trying to sponsor a family that's coming here. Syria's been on the news for the last 5 years. It's been in, it's been part of the history for the last thousands of years. It's kind of a bit sad to see what happened to such an ancient place that we will be talking a little bit more about today. So I'll be talking a little bit about Syria, about the population, starting from history, going through population, ethnicity, diversity, and all the way to the most recent situation in Syria. Why, and maybe how it can be better, which is really a difficult question nowadays. So feel free to ask any questions. I'm going to be sparing a good portion of time, hopefully at the end, so that you can ask. And I do encourage you from now to really ask any question. There is no stupid question. There is no wrong question. There is a lot of things on the media. And unfortunately, media sometimes gives impressions that are not totally accurate about whether the people or the country or the place or what's going on, etc. So I'll be starting by talking about the history of Syria, or actually the geographical location. So probably most of you know where Syria is. Syria is in Asia. It's on the south west side of Asia, very close to Europe through Turkey, and then very close to Africa through Egypt. So that's pretty much the heart of the ancient world. So because of that, it did go through the thousands of years, a lot of historical stories or incidents, if you will. There has been a lot of states, countries, nations, people, you know, coming in and out of Syria because of that location. Whether it's because for trade, whether it's because of even refugee. A lot of people use Syria as a refuge place from other parts of the world. And we're going to know more about when we talk about the ethnicity. It's very, very diverse ethnicity, and main reason is its geographical location. So I'm going to be just using this as a cheat sheet, so excuse me for that. So talking about history, I'm going to mention a couple of things, or actually three things. So Syria hosts two or three of the oldest cities in the world. We have Aleppo, is pretty much the oldest non-inhabited city in the world. There is also Damascus, which is the current capital of Syria. It's also been known as the oldest non-capital inhabited city in the world as well. So that gives you a perception of really how old that piece of the world is, basically. There is also Palmyra. Palmyra is an ancient Semitic city, and probably some of you heard about it on the news. It was captured by ISIS, I believe, last year. It hosts a lot of historical locations, which unfortunately have been destroyed, big part of it. Zenobia, queen of Palmyra, was a strong female figure in that place. It was a very strong, you want to call it an imperial or a state at that time. Another city that I'd like to mention is also Maloula. Maloula means, in Aramaic, entrance. Maloula is located on the north side of Damascus, the capital city. It's one of the very few places in the world that still speak the language of Jesus, which is the Aramaic. Right? They still speak it. They still teach it to their children and kids, and you can see it in everyday life over there. So that's also another place that I'd like to mention, which relates to how old that place is and how religion is also part of the people over there. Talking about the ethnic diversity, it's really very, very diverse. So we know that the Arabs right now can form the majority of it, but it's not the biggest, it's not a very, very big majority. So it's like probably 60%, but there are Kurds, there are Armenians, there are Turkmens, and there are even people from Asia and Africa. So you see a very diverse mix of ethnicities over there, especially if you go to the urban areas. Urban areas where it hosts like big population, you would see dark skin, you would see white skin, you would see yellow skin, you would see different faces, you would see people with a very dark hair, you would see people even with blonde hair. So there is a really rich mix of ethnicity over there, and people live side by side for not centuries, but even for thousands of years. That's the ethnic diversity. There's also the religious diversity. We talked about Malula. That gives you just a perception of how old Christianity is in that place. We know that maybe right now Islam is the biggest majority at the moment, but again, they're not like the only big majority. There is Christians. There is to be lots of Jews. With the foundation of the State of Israel, many or most of the Jews actually left to the State of Israel. There are other religions. There are Druze. There are Ismaili. There are the Nusayri, which is the Alawite, which is the current regime are mostly from. So there are so many religions over there. There are even religions that I personally haven't heard of until very recently, until when the uprising in Syria started to happen, and I became more interested in knowing more about really the diversity inside Syria. And we will know more also once we talk about what's happening right now, but all of these minorities have been impacted by the what's happening in Syria right now. They have been severely impacted, unfortunately, and a lot of history is being destroyed, as we can see in the news, and you'll probably be a little bit more today. The society of Syria. So we talked about ethnicity, we talked about diversity. The Syrian people are by nature educated. So basically, during the First World War, or before the First World War, Syria was part of the Ottoman Empire for hundreds of years. Then the First World War came in, the Ottoman Empire shrunk and then disappeared. And then at some point of time, Syria was under the government or the governing of France for some time. So it was a colony of France for many years. Until the Second World War, a little bit after the Second World War II, Syria has declared independence. And since then, it started like kind of a democratic system. Where there is an election, there is a government that's been elected by the people. But there was also a lot of coups, like military coups. Every once in a while, there is a coup that, you know, overthrow the previous government, and they come to say they want to fix the system, and they want to bring back democracy. So there has been a lot of struggle. You know, going through all of that, I was just about to talk about the society and the characteristics. So people are generally knowledgeable people. So they go to school, they complete higher education. There is a big percentage of people who have completed even university. So you see lots of doctors, engineers, and in many other areas. The population also is family-centered because it's more of towards the Orient. So as you can imagine, it's more of a family conservative-centered, care of the family, care of the elderly, taking care of kids, making sure they're raised properly. So you see that aspect of conservatism in the society over there. So probably some of you know that Steve Jobs came from at least a father who is from Syria. That's pretty much a little bit far a relationship. But a more closer one, there is an actor who actually became a Hollywood actor after the uprising. He left Syria. He's definitely against the regime. His name is Jay Abdo. He's been on a few movies already since he became a part of Hollywood. So he's also from Syria. How about the Syrian in Canada? So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. There is actually good information that's been provided by the government of Canada even before the uprising. It's like good stats that I'd like to go through. So 48 of Syrian origin are university graduates here in Canada, compared to 28% in the total population of Canada. So the Syrian community in Canada is really highly educated with university degree. The rate of females of Syrian origin with a university degree is lower. It's about 45% compared to males, which is about 50%. However, it's still higher than the rate of all Canadian women, which is about 30%. Okay. The labor force participation rate of females of Syrian origin is lower. It's about, sorry, I actually jumped here something. So the labor force of Syrian origin is lower. It's about 80% of the overall Canadian population of 86%. The female is about 72%, which is a little bit lower from the male. And also, it's lower than the average, which is 82% of the whole Canada population. So these are just kind of some information about the Syrian community in Canada who actually migrated. They came to migrate in the late 1800s, basically. With the Lebanese who came to Alberta, first of all, created some small community over there. And if you go to Edmonton, there is one of the biggest community centers for the Lebanese and Syrian in Canada. So, what's happening in Syria? Why it's all over the news? Why there is a problem over there? So, I was talking about the independence, about being a democratic system. There has been a lot of struggle, as you can imagine. A lot of minorities, a lot of groups, different agendas. Until 1960s, there was the rise of the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath Party is an ideology who believes in Arabism and the unity of Arabs. Right, so they kind of tried to take over ruling the country. However, interestingly enough, that within the party itself, there was also a struggle. So although they took power for some time, there was a struggle within the party who would be taking power. Until like 1973, Hafez al-Assad, who actually in a military coup, took the ruling of Syria. Is part of the Ba'ath Party, and he was part of the struggle. Since he took the ruling or the governing of Syria, it became a hard dictatorship. He kind of governed the state with a strong fist, basically. Obviously, it didn't happen in one day. It took some time, but it's you probably can imagine that. How strong it is, because if you know that when he took over in 1973, he was ruling the country until he died in about 2000, I believe 2007. So it was a very strong ruling. There was really at some point no opposition in the country. It was a one-party political system. The media has put more attention in the late years of his ruling, so they created some opposition parties, but really those were just for photo ops and for media. But he used to win every election by 99.9%. So because the people love him so much. And the 1% who didn't vote, they are mostly people are in a coma, so they didn't have a chance to vote. Otherwise, it would be 100%. People are making joke of that. They still claim that it's a democratic system, and there is election. And actually, I did participate in one of those elections, although I never believed. But I just wanted to see how it happens. So you go to the voting poll. You receive a form to fill in. So it has a question. Do you elect Hafez al-Assad as the president of Syria? And you have his picture. So there's only one candidate. So it's a question of yes and no. And then underneath the question, you have two circles. You have a red circle and a green circle. Green is yes, no is red, obviously. What's more funny is that you fill it in, and then you go to the officer. You show him the or her the piece of paper, and you have to show also your ID so that they can record that you voted already. And then they close their eyes. They wouldn't look at what you did vote. Obviously, they would know. And if you vote no, then likely you're going to be disappeared, in a day or two. Best case scenario, you will get beaten up. If you were a good citizen but still said no, and then you'll be returned back. Some people, they just disappeared forever. Right? Another incident that happened through his ruling, as I said, dictatorship didn't happen in one day, so it kind of happened gradually. During the 1980s, there was stronger opposition to his dictatorship. And there was a similar uprising to what's happening right now. And during those days, there has been some kind of military conflict, like what's happening right now. Their response at the time was even harsher because of, media at the time wasn't as good as today. It was easier to kind of keep things within and not go out. So they actually, using the military force, wiped out, for example, half of the city of Hama. If you go to the internet and search for Hama massacre, it's basically a massacre that took place over 2 weeks. They killed between 20 and 60,000 people. Yes, it's a big range because really nobody knows. There was no statistics. One of the very first few people who reported this was a person called Robert Fisk. He's a journalist in the Middle East. He's been there for 35 years now. He's one of the very few who wrote about it. Since that massacre, things have become worse and worse in Syria when it comes to liberty and freedom of society. One thing also is probably interesting to mention is that the ruling Hafez al-Assad, since he took power also, he wanted to make sure that things are all in his hand. So basically, the key parts of the country were really managed and ruled by key people of his family, direct relatives. And he comes from a small minority who believes in Alawites. It's kind of a religion in Syria. They are mostly concentrated on the west side of Syria, on the Mediterranean coast. So you would see, unfortunately, because the ruling regime comes from that minority, unfortunately, there's a reaction from other groups who kind of, I don't like to use this word, but they hate, kind of, it created a lot of hate. There has been a lot of, people wanted to take revenge. They think, that religion promotes the killing of others, and they are oppressing us, and they are killing us, just because this guy came from them. Besides the oppression and the killing, a lot of families in Syria, especially I was mentioning the city of Hama. The city of Hama in 1982, after the Hama massacre, there was really no single family who had either a person who's been killed or jailed or missing. Right? So because of this strong conflict, there has been a lot of impact to a lot of the families. And people, you know, because of the strong fist of ruling, you can't say nothing, you can't talk nothing, you can't express. Even I remember when I was a small kid, I used to be told, you know, wolves have ears. Don't even think about the regime or talk about it or criticize it. 2011, this is kind of a little bit of a longer introduction, but I thought maybe it's useful to put things into perspective. Arab Spring came up around 2009, 2010, in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya. So the Syrian people thought, why not us? Maybe it's time for us to get liberated from this 40 years of dictatorship. And I, by the way, didn't talk about his son who took over from him the presidency, which is Bashar al-Assad. But if time permits, maybe I'll mention a little funny story about it as well. And actually before the uprising in Syria starts, there was an interview with Bashar al-Assad, I think, on CNN. He was asked if that's going to come to Syria. I said, no, it's not. It's never going to come to Syria. The Syrian people are very, very happy. So shortly after that, the uprising started. But really, what was the trigger of the uprising in Syria? There was an interesting story, which is also popular and known. In the south city of Daraa, on the border with Jordan, that city is known of being one of the strongest supporters to the regime. Obviously, the regime has supported this. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't be in power for so long. Some kids in Daraa went out of the school and they were watching news, Arab Spring, you know, calling for freedom. So they kind of wrote on the wall like, you know, we're looking for freedom and we need freedom and things like that. Those kids, they were teenagers, literally. They were captured by the security intelligence. And by the way, Syria hosts one of the biggest numbers of independent security, intelligence security in the world. So many security intelligence groups that are independent from each other because they used to kind of spy on each other to make sure nobody has loyalty outside to the regime. Anyway, so they were captured. Their nails were taken out as a way of torture. And even worse, they called their fathers, or their fathers came to kind of take their kids back. And they were told by one of the leaders in the security organization, he was telling them, forget about these kids, bring us your wives and we'll get you another different kid. So that was his response to them. For a conservative society to say that, it's very bad. And that triggered it, and literally that's what, you know, people started to come out of the streets in Daraa. They were shouting against the regime. They were actually calling at the beginning to take that guy and replace him with a different guy. Obviously, their demand hasn't been met because there is no demand in Syria. Obviously, there's just no demand. You can't ask for anything. So the response, you know, was a bit harsher to those protests and then started to spread out throughout the country. So that happened in the spring of 2011. And then it started to spread out throughout the country. It started very peaceful. Peaceful process for almost a year. I mean, some people might say there was shooting here and there, but really there was nothing organized. People were just, you know, going out in protests in the street. There were too many for the government or to the regime to kind of respond to each one of them through, you know, all over the country. People were chanting, singing. But however, there were harsh response. They were putting snipers on top of buildings, shooting people, killing people. A lot of people started to flee the country starting 2011, but not so much until 2015, and I'll also say why it hasn't started massively until then. So things got deteriorated more and more. Obviously, the international community response There is a debate about that. Maybe it wasn't adequate or it wasn't up to the scale. At least people didn't think it's gonna, you know, the regime is gonna be as bad. You know, we saw in Egypt Hosni Mubarak step down. We saw in Tunisia, you know, Ben Ali step down. People thought maybe this guy would step down. Unfortunately, some people, especially the close allies, they believe this guy is a god, so they cannot imagine country without him. So the response got harsher and harsher until it reached a stage where there has been mass killings. The regime started using barrel bombs indiscriminately, using their planes. I'm not sure if you heard about barrel bombs. It's just a barrel that's filled with explosives and nails and whatever garbage. And then they go up and then they throw them on targets. You know, I'm not sure how accurate those targets are, just throwing the barrel. Just to have mass destruction. Now, what made things worse is that when the international community drew a red line, don't use chemical weapon, otherwise there will be consequences. Yes, they used it, and there was no consequences, unfortunately. I mean, the pictures of kids and women and civilians, you know, shivering and dying slowly because of the chemical weapons was horrible. Syria at the time used to be known one of the biggest countries in storing chemical weapons in the world, so they started using it then on against their people. The regime throughout their 30, 40 years, in order to kind of make sure they have a strong control of the country, they obviously created issues between minorities. So they used to help minority against another minority. They used to kind of hire people from one minority to spy on another minority or things like that. So they kind of created some kind of fraction in the society. So when the uprising happened, they kind of took advantage of that. And there was, as I said, there was lots of hate. Hate has been building up for years. And when there was a little room of kind of people started wanting to kind of take revenge and created those groups who want to kind of, they have their own agenda and wanted to breach things that they had in mind for a long, long time. So it started peacefully. It started between the people and the regime. Quickly enough, it developed, and then you started to see groups here and there. The beginning of the uprising, you know, we're following up the news closely. We knew who are the main groups. It reached to a point where I can't even, you know, not only name them, even know how many of them are. Everyone has a different flag. And it's not really, you know, it's not Islam against, it's not Sunni against Shia, it's against Christianity. You can find, you know, the majority is the Sunni Arab. There are like tens of groups, they're fighting against each other, you know. They're killing each other before they're killing anybody else. It's because just to come from different locations, from different cities, from different backgrounds, it became to a horrible situation. So the regime took advantage of all of that. ISIS rise up and started to kind of rise up in 2012-2013. They took over a main city in Syria called Raqqa. It wasn't in the news for some reason. For over a year, nobody was even paying attention to them, although they were killing here and there in Iraq and Syria and doing suicide bombs. They suddenly came into the picture when they started to behead, unfortunately, Western people. One maybe comment, it's more of a personal comment, unfortunately here in the West, we don't start to feel and see things until they start to hit us. So we're living in a small world. We're not far from anywhere anymore. And sometimes ignorance is not a good thing. Sometimes you need to do a little bit more than that. Anyway, so the uprising of ISIS, obviously the regime, you know, took that to his advantage. It was also known that the regime hasn't bombed or attacked ISIS for almost a year. since they kind of became to be strong, and that's well documented, by the way. They haven't sent planes there, they haven't sent army there. They were letting ISIS fighting the other groups. ISIS was not fighting even the regime. The regime was not fighting, ISIS was fighting another group for a long time. Now maybe they're fighting against each other, but at that time they were not. That was well recorded. So, why the massive waves of escapes all of a sudden? I mean, 2011, 12, 15, 14. There has been refugees. They were going to Turkey, to Lebanon, to Jordan. Turkey hosted over 1.5 million. Jordan, almost 1 million, less than 1 million. In Lebanon, for every 3 people, there's one Syrian right now. It's a small, tiny country. They're hosting lots of refugees. The population of Syria, the last recorded one, which is a bit old, is about 27 million. 8 million were displaced inside the country, and 5 million outside the country. That's 13 million. That's almost half of the population. So half of the population has been misplaced. At some point of time, there was 1 million kids with no access to education. In this time of the world, 1 million kids, now it's even more maybe sometimes, according to some records. It's horrible numbers, and it's numbers coming from the United Nations, so it's not, you know, it's not this or that who's claiming those numbers. To me personally, knowing that there's 1 million kids with no access to education was one of the very worst news in this conflict, because that by itself is an environment to create more extremists, to create more crazy people to fuel what's happening. So 2011, 12, 15, 14 people were fleeing, but close by, not with really huge waves outside Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. And then all of a sudden, 2015, people started to flee out. Why? You know, a lot of people were asking, including myself. To me, it was easier to find the answer because I've been in contact with many people inside and outside Syria who were fleeing in close by areas. I'm not sure how much time we have left. Am I 25 minutes? Okay, I'll try and wrap up very quickly so that I can give you a chance for Q&A. 2011, 12, 13, 14, we were talking to people. People were just hopeful. They said, you know, although there is a lot of, you know, problems, conflict, killings, destruction, but we're hopeful that this is going to, you know, end soon. And we're going to come back to normal lives and live our own life. But really it became so much complicated to a point where people started to like, who's with who? Who's fighting who? Who's that flag and what's that flag? And how do I to who I belong, right? So it became, it reached a point where obviously people started to lose hope, literally. And there is no light at the end of the tunnel that anybody can see. And then it's then when people started to flee. Right? They reached a point where being on a rubber boat in the middle of the ocean is safer than sitting at home, closing your door. Right? Hoping to what I will get after I arrive on my rubber boat, if I arrive safely, is better than trying to go to school or work or shopping at home. They've literally reached to that point. Even worse, they reached to a point where there is no end to this, right? There is no end to this. It's been 4 or 5 years. I've been trying to escape barrel bombs, you know, every day. Every day I'm survived, it's one more day in my life. I have no future. Even worse, there's no future to my kids. Right? So people started to flee in crazy numbers. And we've seen the huge numbers walking literally throughout Europe. After even some of them used to swim literally. Right? Some of them used to, I know stories where people go to some parts of Turkey, they swim for a few kilometers in the middle of the night in the ocean to reach an island and then to take another trip to Nitra, another island, and then they reach Greece. They put their papers, they give them some temporary papers to kind of sort out their things, because Greece was in a very bad economic situation. It was nice of them to even let the people stay for a while until they complete their journey through. And people were walking literally in Europe. By the end of 2015, Germany alone had 1 million. 1 million refugees, maybe not all Syrian, but 70% or 80% of them were Syrian. So that was another thing that alarmed the world in general, that, well, we should respond to this right now. And the world starts to kind of be more really engaged and involved in trying to solve the problem. We're living in a small world. It's not like before. Anything happens anywhere is going to impact us. That's why we care about North Korea having nuclear bombs. That's why we care about Iran maybe having nuclear bombs. That's why we care about freedom and liberty maybe in China or some other part of the world. So people started to flee, and the response started. Here in Canada, throughout the uprising, many communities, many people wanted to help, but there wasn't much besides making donations. Right? The United Nations have asked big countries to start and take refugees. The response was very, very slow, very low, and not even close up to the needful. With the new government stepping up, we at the Syrian Canadian Council and many other organizations, we appreciated the initiative by the Canadian government to respond to the ask from the general Canadian population to receive more people. So the government announced accepting 50,000 refugees, 25,000 in a very short period of time. That's already been met, and then until the end of this year, they're going to keep bringing people throughout private sponsorship or government-assisted sponsorship until the end of the year. The overwhelming support and response from everybody was really overwhelming to us. People wanted to help. People wanted to be supportive. And that's what even formed Canada, right? Canada history is a group of different people who came from different parts of the world, escaping from wars, even south the border in the 1800s, and from Europe as well. So this is a rooted Canadian culture and history, which is accepting and helping most affected people in the world. So people start to come here to Canada, and obviously to the refugees and to us, it's not the end of things, it's really the very start of it, right? People are coming here not by a choice. Myself and many other people came by a choice. I actually, spend a big portion of my life making sure that I can or could be able to come and live in Canada. I believe in the culture. I believe that it's a land that I can live and raise my kids in. But these people were not, they didn't come here by a choice. The vast majority of them were in Jordan or Lebanon. Somebody called them from the United Nations and said, "Hey, you have a chance to come to Canada. Would you like to come?" Said, anywhere in the place probably is better than where I am, right? A lot of them don't even know where Canada is, literally. A lot of people don't have that level of education, especially if they come from villages or suburbs that are far away from the city. So they started to come here. I can talk a little bit about the people who started to come here, and then I'll talk about, also touch base about the culture, which probably would relate to what you are going to be expecting. Now, I think the good thing in your case that at least you know the names and you have the pictures and you know the background of the family who's coming. The other church you probably are referring to, they had no idea who these people are. Not, no pictures, no information about their religion or where they are coming from. So we were kind of preparing a plan to kind of accommodate every expectation. So the people here, generally speaking, most of them don't have knowledge about English. Syria, because of the Ba'ath Party and believing in the Arabism ideology, they didn't promote learning any foreign language. Even the French, which normally, if you are a colony, you used to be a colony to another country, that language would normally be popular. So even French is not that popular in Syria, so let alone English. So a lot of the people who comes here come with very, very little English, if at all. Like, some of them have really zero knowledge of English, which is a very big challenge and a barrier to integrate in Canada. I'm not sure if you know maybe more about the family you're receiving. If they have any sort level of English, that would be very, very helpful in dealing with them. Otherwise, it will be challenging. We're going to need people to help you with translation, every single thing you want to do for them, which is not easy. We are, like, there are, the government has been, and other organizations have been hiring a lot of interpreters. We are the Syrian Canadian Council, we're just a group of volunteers. We made our cell phones available to organizations to call us if they need any translation. We can't accommodate going on person anymore. We used to at the beginning, but we're just turning 10. And I know other communities from Arab-speaking communities are also making themselves available, but the Arabic community is small, relatively in Vancouver, so it's not easy to accommodate. And then all of a sudden, you're bringing literally 2,000 or 3,000 Syrians with no English. It's not easy to kind of respond to that efficiently. Talking about the people who come here, again, depending on the level of education, the level of exposure they had to other parts of the world, you would see different, or you would expect different things from them. So they come here, they come from a dictatorship state, they come from an environment of fear, they come from, because they didn't come directly from there, let's remember that. Most of them left Syria 2012 or 13, and they are in Lebanon or Jordan. I'm not sure if you know where they're coming from, Lebanon. And they lived in also a harsh situation there because they have been treated not well, obviously not a citizen, not even as a respected visitor. Their only way to get things is to scream and shout and cry to the UN to kind of get their basic necessities, whether it's food. They were not allowed to work in Jordan and Lebanon. Literally, they're not allowed to work. Like, people, they wanted to work. They're just not allowed to work. And whoever was able to work, most of them were able to work, like, cash, illegal. So they come from a difficult situation to here. So there is some kind of a shock when people come here. It's a very nice place, nice weather, everything is there. But still, you know, you didn't plan for this. You didn't think about this. You don't even the name of the cities. You don't know what to expect. So there is a bit of a shock. And organizations, you know, like you, want to help and trying to bring the family, and also want to make sure that they're doing the right thing, which is a very noble and nice thing. You know, they want to know about the culture and what they like, they don't like. At least to kind of ease the first part of their arrival, right? I'm not sure how far you're with the preparation there, but there are, you know, few things that can be considered in mind when they come here. I would, you know, think that you probably went through some or made some progress there, knowing what needs to be done from the paperwork side of it. You know, could be health insurance, could be, you know, permanent resident cards, how to kind of work on that, getting their driver license if they want to. Some of them comes with driver license from Syria. They still need to assess that and and do the test, the driving test, whether it's the written or the driving itself. And there's also the bank accounts. You know, I've seen people who... Another thing I didn't mention also, which so many things, banking system in Syria, because it's more of a communist ideology than being capitalist ideology. For a long, long, long time, there was only state banks, and people cannot open bank accounts easily. A lot of people don't even know what bank accounts are, and if they know, they obviously don't know what credit cards are. So you would expect lack of knowledge, what we believe here to be, you know, what do you call it, an obvious thing, right? I was in the middle of a crowd of refugees, and they started to ask about credit card. And I was like, I didn't know how to explain this, and I tried like a few times to help them understand, how can I spend the money that I don't own using a card? How am I going to be able to pay it back? Is this just given to me, or it's a loan? Why they're giving it to me for free? What are they getting out of it? What's the catch? You know, all these kind of things, right? On the other hand, they come with nice, where they come, for example, with nice phones. You know, people, when it comes to using phones and technology, they're not bad at it. They know how to use internet. If it's in their language, obviously, which is Arabic. A lot of them are open-minded. The vast majority of them, simply because Syria, as I said, it's a diverse culture. Right? People used to live side by side for thousands of years. I would be lying if I said with no problems. Obviously, there's always problems. You know, every part of the world, we had our own problems here in Canada. But they still, you know, over the last thousands of years, were able to live, you know, side by side. And the proof is that they're still living side by side until, until the recent uprising. So they're generally open-minded. As I said, so you, in terms of the family you're sponsoring, it's it comes from an Armenian background. Victoria is going to speak to that, and she comes from that community. So I'm sure she's going to help be able to help with that. So this is just a high level of the culture, high level of what to expect. You're taking a noble work on your shoulder, and I don't want to scare you, but also I don't want to you to underestimate it. Like I see the feedback from other churches that, you know, we found out it's more of a work than before, simply because of the logistics, you know, the language, the paperwork, things to be done. I think you're lucky that you're doing it now. You can ask other churches about the process. A lot of the churches that we used to work with them, they were doing things for the first time. They had nobody to ask. They didn't have much source of information. The whole thing, even the government itself, because the decision was made in a very short period of time, and the execution wanted to be done in a very, very short period of time. So things were not even ready on the government level. So let alone on organization. Non-profit organization level. So, I think I'll stop here, and I'll give a chance to ask questions. And again, I mean, please ask any question, whether it's a difficult question. I like difficult questions. I like challenging questions. I like the questions who come, you know, from what we see in the media. You know, ask about Daesh or ISIS. What do we expect from people from there? What do we see? What do they believe in? You know, things like that. You know, anything. So I'll open it for questions. And thanks for your patience listening to me. I know it's been speaking for a long time now. Yes. Okay, very good question. I'll repeat the question. What are the criteria for the UN to choose people to come to Canada, right? So there is UN criteria and there is Canadian criteria, by the way. So there are two levels of criteria, right? So there is the UN criteria. UN criteria is a little bit more humanistic. So basically, people, when they flee a country to another country, and they do and go and register with the United Nations, they have to go through a registration process. to be a recognized refugee status. So the United Nations record their stories, where they're coming from, all the details, why you are fleeing, was there any threat, you know, things like that. But because of the situation has become so bad, and people are coming in overwhelming number, it was you know, easier to accept people as a refugee status than if it was, you know, a smaller scale, because of the huge impact. So people get registered with the United Nations. Once they're registered, United Nations, in an ideal situation, they kind of follow up with these people about their status, where they're working, not working. Obviously, most of them are not legally allowed to work, so they would get support from the United Nations by getting food and some cash and trying to help them get into school, because they're, besides not allowed to be working, they're not allowed to send their kids to the government schools also. And obviously, people, most of them don't afford sending them to private schools, so education was always a challenge. Many kids I've seen, they have missed schools for the last 1 or 2 years at least. So that's the first level. Now, when Canada decided to bring people, you know, it was a, you know, honestly, it was a very brave decision that they made the decision and also proceeded with it, because it came in the middle of the Paris terror attack, right? The Canadian government still pursued and proceeded with it. So they have set criteria to ensure the safety and security. Obviously, this is a concern of all of us. I want the security of myself, my kids, and family as well. So as I do like the Canadian government to bring people, I want to also do like to make sure that they're doing the due diligence to make sure that they're bringing the right people. Right? It's important to say, though, that the Syrian population in no scale is a reflection of what ISIS, Daesh believe or other terror organizations believe, whether it's, I don't want to mention religions, but there are, you know, extremists on pretty much each part of it. The number is just a reflection of the percentage, generally, at least in that part of the world. So they do go through a rigorous interview process. It's like the information I got is from the government and also from the people who arrived here. I can ask them, hey, what happened? How were you qualified? So the Canadian government is picking up the people who are well known to the United Nations, which means people are either in refugee camp for a couple of 3 years, or even living in the city for 2 or 3 years, who are registered refugee for a long time. They are also going through a rigorous interview process. They go through a few cycles of process, of interview, sorry. In each interview, they're asked so many questions, from even the time they know what the world is, like from becoming a teenager or high school, all the way until they, the current moment they were interviewed. And they've been asked those questions over and over to make sure that they're providing the right answers. They were also checking their files and their history, obviously. And also, there are certain criteria, which is probably that didn't come from the government, but that's more of an observation. The vast majority of the people who are coming here are like big families, like parents with kids, you know, young kids and bigger kids. They're not bringing. I'm not saying that's the right thing, by the way. I mean, single people could be more vulnerable to issues than families, but at least the observation is that they're being big families. Knowing that the society there is more of a family-centric, you know, you can imagine that's a factor that would probably consider. They're bringing people from also well-known impacted areas, you know, there are those homes, not under, you know, estimating the issues in other parts of Syria, but it's all that, but there's really worse areas than others. So they go through that rigorous process, and these are the main criteria to bring people. Obviously, there is also looking for the impacted people, like injured people, people with disabilities, like the other church that I've been working with. The family has really a special situation. One of the kids has a permanent disability. The father has also some health issues, things like that. When it comes to government private sponsorship families, they're more vulnerable than the government assisted, because the government brought families, they don't get the same level of care when there is a private sponsor waiting for them. So this is on a high level, you know, not getting into the detail, but does that answer your question somehow? Yeah? Yes. Very good question. So I'll repeat the question in case you didn't hear it. He's saying that he understands that Christians are probably one of the most impacted minorities being killed and chased and terrorized. And maybe it makes sense to kind of bring them here more safely. A very good point. And I agree with you. The thing that I would add, it's not only the Christians. Right? And also I'd like to add that even the majority, which is the Arab Sunni, they were the first ones who started to be killed before anybody else. And they were killed by their own Arab Sunni people. Right? When ISIS started to kill people, they started to kill the Arab Sunni people before anybody else. Before they behead the journalists on TV, they were beheading tens of people. Before they do any suicide bomb in Paris or Belgium, they were doing daily suicide bombs in Baghdad, in Mosul, in every city, in Damascus, in Aleppo, in Syria. Right? So, really, with no discrimination, everybody is impacted, because they reach to a point, those extremists, it's either with us or against us. You can't be on the fence, right? And that's one of the reasons, by the way, if you read about ISIS, most of the fighters, they're not Syrians. They're not Syrians. The people of Syria, they don't believe in that, right? So they're bringing fighters from all over the world. They're bringing them from Europe, right? From Russia. A lot of people are coming from Russia, by the way. Syria has become the land. It's like a war zone, like a buffer war zone, right? It's like, you and I have a problem, let's not fight here, let's go to Syria and fight. Or you know what, I'll fund my people, you fund your people, and let's do it over there. That's what's happening. There's Russia, there is the United States, there is Europe, there is Saudi Arabia, there is Turkey, there is Jordan. Everybody's hand inside Syria right now. Even one of the party leaders in Lebanon. I don't want to mention names, so I don't get into politics. But he was saying on a public interview, because, you know, in Lebanon it's not very stable either. There is a lot of political conflict, and some people wanted to kind of fight his party or kind of do some problems inside Lebanon. And he said on TV, he said, if you have problem with us, don't fight with us in Lebanon. Leave Lebanon in peace. Let's go and meet in Syria. It's broken down many, many times. It's relatively better than before the ceasefire, right? The regime stopped throwing barrel bombs for a while. Now they're back. For the last week, they're bombing every day using barrel bombs. They stopped when the Russian kind of came in and started to helping them more. Since the Russian withdrawal, they came back to throwing barrel bombs. This is crimes against humanity, right? Where is the international world? Where is the international court, right? They used to kind of charge people for things. I'm not saying it's the regime only. It started probably that the regime only was doing these things. Now it's a lot of other groups. It's not only ISIS, by the way, either. It's not the regime only. It's not ISIS only. it has become so complex that it's really hard to know what's going on. I have the same question as you. Probably I know a little bit more for the answer than you, but I have the same question. They are a wealthy country. They should host people. And since the international world has increased on Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, they started to take people, not as a refugee, because you cannot take Saudi citizenship at all, no matter what you do, generally speaking. So they're accepting them as visitors. They started to give them some benefits like health, and they allowed them to work, which is in a normal situation they wouldn't allow to anybody. Not saying that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, but there is a little bit of response, but I share the same question as you. Yes. Yes. Yeah, is there helpful phrases that we can learn in Arabic to kind of help welcome refugees? Thanks, that's very nice of you. There are a few things that I can share. I can email it to Diana also, like how it's written in Arabic, how it's pronounced in English. So you can say, for example, hello, like marhaba, 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 right? I started with peace be with you. It's very common. Assalamu alaikum. It's very, very common in the Arab world. It's probably hard to pronounce, a bit harder to pronounce. I'll send it by email as well. So, I mean, I appreciate that you're trying. I very much appreciate that. But I also, it's fair, I want to be fair and say that Arabic language is one of the most difficult languages in the world. It's not an easy language, at least to pronounce. So I definitely would share with Diana, and then you can take it from there. Yes. Yes. Thank you, yeah. So, two things is, what are the known major culture shocks? And the second one is about food and hospitality and the culture around it. Probably I'll start with the second question. So, food is an important part of Syrian culture. The Syrian cuisine, which is not very much popular around the world, it's more of the Lebanese cuisine that takes the name, but they're very close cuisine. There are a huge variety of foods and generosity and hospitality. It's mostly around food, about inviting people to food parties and sharing food. Like you can expect people that would cook something and then knock the door and then say, oh, we cooked something nice, wanted to share it with you, and they give you something. Right? One of the things that's probably a little bit funny and good to know is that when you're invited to eat, there is the insistence of eating more, you know, because they think that you're not eating enough because you're shy and you just want to stop at some point, and then, no, you have to eat, you have to eat, you didn't eat enough, you have to eat, oh, you don't like the food? So I remember one time someone was making a joke and he said that I came from the West and I was invited in Syria to a meal to my aunt. And then I knew she's going to be swearing and insisting so much, so I didn't really fill my stomach. I was like, I stopped at half stomach. And I said to my aunt, thank you, I had enough. And she said, you know what, I know you're coming from the West. You hate insistence. I'm not going to insist. I said, oh my goodness, I stopped. No, I'll come back. No. But really, a lot of people don't know about, we might feel it's inappropriate ourselves, but, it's different. General thing, sometimes we think it's, some things we think it's nice, it might not be the case there, and it's the vice versa. This is one of the things that, you know, we didn't get used to. So that's about food. General guidelines about food. The majority, simply because they come from the Muslim religion, they don't eat pork. Even I know personally a lot of Christians, they don't eat pork. Not because it's not allowed by the religion, just because it becomes part of the culture, right? Drinking, obviously, is also not a popular part of the culture. You'll see people drink, but it's not also a very popular thing in Syria. So these are the main things. About the major culture shock. I mentioned language is really the biggest major one. People, as I said, they're open-minded. One thing that might not be applicable to your family or might, I don't know. People come from a harsh situation where you have to really fight to get your rights. Right? So they don't know what to expect. They only know that you have to keep asking. So I think one important aspect of the general guidelines is setting expectation properly, no matter how obvious it is, right? Setting expectation in terms of what you're going to get out of health, what you're going to get out of social support, what you're going to get out from the government, what the government gives, what the government doesn't give, what is the expectation from you that you're going to need to learn language, you're going to need to be, you know, upgrade your work, skills, and engage these things. The sense of volunteerism also is not a known thing in Syria. Like, what's volunteering? It's not a term that people would comprehend easily, that why would you do something for free? Right? So it's good to let them know that you're doing it for free. You're doing it for the good of people. Right? You're not doing it out of benefit from anybody, from anyone. Right? So, and we can help you with that. Either myself or be in touch with Diana will definitely connect people to help with setting those expectations up. Even with myself, like, people start to struggle. Why are you helping us not getting anything out of us, right? Right. So these kind of things, it's just simply because they come from that isolated part of the world, you know, and it's part of the reality that we're going to need to deal with. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but these are some of the points. Yeah. Yes. Am I? We're running out of time. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. I am available. I'll be staying here. If you have any question, any comments, I'll be here. You know, glad to be here again. And I can spend as much time as you want. So thanks, Diana, and thanks everyone.
At this time, we're going to be preparing for communion. So, Evelyn, if you can lead us in response. And